because they send a message of ending impunity, of an end to a political class removed from the reality of the people.
Por lo tanto, acabar con esos privilegios es algo que se puede hacer inmediatamente, nada más llegar a la institución y que depende.
So to do away with these privileges is something that we can do immediately, as soon as we take office. It depends only on political will. Without a doubt, one of the first steps as mayor will be to publicly convene all the banks who work in the city and to sit them around the negotiating table in order to stop the evictions and to say that we need the empty homes that they have in the city as social affordable rental housing for the families who need it.
Para ponerlas en alquiler social para las familias que lo necesitan.
Ada Colau, thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations as the first woman mayor of Barcelona, Spain. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Barcelona mayor-elect Ada Colau. We will be posting the original interview in Spanish on our website, democracynow.org. Just click on Español. And that does it for our show. Special thanks to Chuck Skurich, Julie Crosby, Clara Ibarra, Igor Moreno, Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dennis Moynihan, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. And welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. Today is Friday, June the 5th. Happy June. Okay. My name is Jay Korenik, station advisor for WHFR. Thank you for listening today. I'm here with WHFR news director, John Conroy. Welcome back, John.
Yeah, thank you, Jay. It's good
and
to be
our special guest to start off the hour is from the Arab American National Museum, Devin Ackman, who is the director. Welcome, Devin. It's your first visit here.
It is. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here, and thanks for, I guess it's kind of an exciting time, 10th anniversary for the Arab American National Museum. It's the 30th anniversary this year, by the way, for WHFR being on the air. And I remember our 10th, it was a big deal. We didn't think we'd make it 2 or 3 years because we, you know, just had a few volunteers, and now we have more than 60 volunteers and, you know, are able to do enough fundraising to keep going. We're a nonprofit, you might say, within Henry Ford College's nonprofit structure. They give us a little small stipend, which is the same, just so you know, as all the other clubs or the campus newspaper. But 60-70% of our budget, and we don't pay people, so most of the budget just goes on equipment and computers and things like that, actually comes from volunteers and special fundraising. Well, the Arab American Museum is in that situation. You're an official nonprofit and always involved in fundraising. Let's just start by, since it is the anniversary, give us a brief history of how the Arab American Museum came about.
Well, first off, congrats, 30 years. Well, that's fantastic. I mean, that's a testament to the hard work and great programming. So Congratulations.
Thank you.
Wow, 10 years. Yeah, it's pretty pretty hard to believe that we've already gotten to that major milestone. And looking back on the first decade, you know, we have a lot that we can be really, really proud of. First and foremost, we've become Southeast Michigan's only affiliate of the Smithsonian Institution, which is huge in and of itself. That allows us to do all kinds of programs with essentially the National Museum of America down in Washington, D.C. Within that time frame, we've also become an accredited museum by the American Alliance of Museums. That's the professional body for our industry. And believe it or not, only 7% of museums nationwide are accredited. So to do that in your first 10 years is a major milestone for us.
So what does it mean if you're not accredited? You just don't have as many options to either raise money from foundations,
you know, or it's a gold,
it's a status thing.
It's a status thing. It's a gold standard. But, it It lets your donors, your peers in the industry, it essentially lets everybody know that you're operating at the highest standards from a collection standpoint, from a governance standpoint, and from a fiscal responsibility. So, mm-hmm. In that regard, it lets people know that we're the real deal. And as a new institution, as the only institution of its kind nationwide, there's nobody else telling the Arab American story. Mm-hmm. That's a very important seal of approval to have, right. Because we're based in Dearborn, but we're a national institution. So folks in Southeast Michigan tend to be a little more familiar with our work, but when we're out doing our national work, these important credentials provide us with a certain level of authenticity and it helps us. Let's be blunt. It helps us with our work nationwide. So, mm-hmm. So in addition to an affiliation status, accreditation status, we've designed award-winning programs, national programs that are happening around the country as we speak right now. We just opened an exhibition in Los Angeles, an art show.
Wow.
We have another show that's being, it's closing. It's at the University of Texas, the Institute of Texan Cultures on the San Antonio campus.
Oh, okay.
And when that show's done, it's heading, believe it or not, to the State Department of all.
And that's because you have such a unique collection.
Yeah.
Of course, such credibility, too, right. From, yep. that you can, you should be sharing it.
Yeah.
Of course,
yeah.
That takes money, too. And, of course, when the exhibits travel, the host museum or college, they can pay some of that money, or they pay all
in
of it.
Principle.
In principle. In principle, yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You get support wherever you can get it.
You get it where you can. I mean, yeah. let's put it, the first 10 years, it was about, building credibility, building a staff, building a presence, local and national. And when we're taking our programs and exhibitions nationally, we always like to be able to recoup some kind of revenue, but sometimes you just find a venue that's just too important for your institutional advancement, and, mm-hmm. and you make it happen. An example of that would be last year we took our Patriots and Peacemakers exhibit, an exhibition that looks at Arab American service to this nation since its founding, and we presented that on Capitol Hill at the Russell Senate Office Building. There's no government line item to bring exhibitions there, but we thought it was so important to inform the congressional delegation of the Arab American story that we just, we went out to our own community and raised the funds to make it happen.
Wow.
And the birth of the idea for the museum, it grew out of the fact that the Access organization had already been here more than 20 years, maybe more than 30. Access is in its 44 years.
Yeah.
Right. And primarily that was Ishmael Ahmed and other people in the
yes.
community, but Ishmael was always the leader for many of those decades. And so we should mention his name because
Absolutely.
Obviously he wanted to see the Arab American National Museum become a reality. And other people that you want to mention?
Yeah,
obviously
yeah.
Obviously there's committees and
there's committees.
Organizers, and it probably is, dozens. But.
Yeah, I mean, we're a museum about people first and foremost. So there were a lot of individuals, but obviously, Ishmael was the CEO of Access, mm-hmm. but Access had the foresight in the 1980s to start a cultural arts department, and that's what the museum is an outgrowth of. So we're still part of Access, and Dr. Anan Amari was our founding director. She mm-hmm. played an instrumental role in the cultural arts department, an instrumental role of going around the country and engaging the Arab American community, and frankly, she led us for the first 8 years of our existence and mm-hmm. helping us to build what we have right now. So those were really the key figures. Maha Frej, our CFO, who is out there raising funds nationally to make this mm-hmm. happen. But literally dozens and dozens and dozens of figures in communities nationwide who right. really activated their own communities, places like LA and Boston, to make this a reality.
That's great. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You've been director then for the last couple of years.
2 years now, yeah. Yeah. Almost okay. 2 years to the day coming up here very soon. I've been with the museum since we opened. I started fresh out of graduate school and was a curator for approximately 4 years. Mm. Was then promoted to deputy director and served in that role for just under 4 years. And then
I see.
Have led the institution for the last two. But I'm third generation Lebanese. And as I was finishing graduate school, I certainly wasn't planning on working in a museum. Mm-hmm. I had some experience as an undergraduate working at Michigan State University Museum, but mm-hmm. I was looking at urban planning. You know, mm-hmm. That was mm-hmm. really what made me excited when I woke up in the morning transforming cities. And
yeah, it's a great idea if anybody would ever try it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, the reason I made that joke is because we have obviously people here at Henry Ford College who teach in political science and sociology. They have their background in urban planning. And the academics idea of urban planning is very rarely able to translate into the political reality. That is the problem. There's a lot of great ideas from a lot of great research, and trying to get it to happen is really the ultimate problem. And they don't teach that in urban planning. I mean, you're talking about the better ideas and what's worked in the past and research on other possibilities, but how do you make it happen? Now, obviously, with being a museum director, you're in charge of all the things that are happening that influence this area, mm-hmm. not just the Arab American community, mm-hmm. but this area and other areas around the country. So in a way, that's a lot of power. It's a lot of influence, actually, making things happen. And we all, I mean, certainly here at WHFR, we believe that culture is an important key to driving the society in the direction we want to go.
Yes.
So we have to have the best examples and you know, we have to curate, we have to select, and we have to challenge people, too. Well, looking at your website, which is, folks, if you want to go check it out, ArabAmericanMuseum.org, okay, ArabAmericanMuseum.org, exhibits, collection, library and resources, numerous events, we'll talk later, maybe do that one last, about Concert of Colors and Global Music, and educational activities, too. Let's start with the collection. There is a basic museum collection mm-hmm. of, I assume, paintings and sculpture. And
we have three-dimensional objects, we have art, we have basic ephemera, archival collections, you name it. I mean, it really runs the gamut. 99% of our collection was donated by the Arab American community nationwide. A lot of those materials obviously are on the galleries, but we also have a research collection and storage. And lately we've been building a very robust archival collection. That's where our attention's been turned. So looking at key individuals, key organizations, and trying to build that out. We actually launched a travel grant for researchers in the past year and a half, 2 years. So that's a key focus. That's how we further the research on Arab Americans. It's through the collection and having a robust collection. So there's certainly a key portion of our work that's aimed at building that. And oral histories, I should add, is part of that, building a robust oral history collection and making that accessible.
And, well, you're focusing, therefore, on the Arab American experience.
Yes.
But there must be some connections to the origins, mm-hmm. I mean, to the culture in the Middle East.
To an extent, I mean, our key story, or what we're chiefly looking at are, you know, the reasons why we're here in this country and how our narrative fits within the Arab or the greater American narrative, I should say. So obviously what makes us unique is our Arabness, if you want to call it that, what we bring from the old world. And we bring that story out through both our exhibits and our collection, but also we're positioning that story and looking at that narrative in context to what makes us uniquely American as a nation.
Great. I don't think a lot of people understand that distinction, even though the name should say it all, mm-hmm. Arab American National mm-hmm. Museum. John, you want to have a question?
Yeah, I had a thought. What was the trigger that got you particularly interested in museum work and as well as the Arab American National Museum?
Frankly, it had a lot to do with 9/11. You know, I never had, you know, I don't really pass when you look at me as being Arab American. I think most people would just think I'm some white guy, you know. And after 9/11, my family, obviously my parents, my sister, who's a bit darker complected than I, we began to see some of those negative things happening to them. And coincidentally, as I was finishing graduate school, I began to learn about this project, this idea of a museum that was soon to be opening, and I learned of the director's vision. So on a whim, I applied, never thinking I'd even get an interview, and I was so fortunate to actually get the position. So that began the 10-year journey to where we are now, and then just to kind of loop back to where I was prior to that, you know, finishing a graduate degree, thinking about urban planning and preservation planning. As you mentioned, a lot of kind of our vision as an institution right now kind of draws on that. So we're looking at placemaking. We're looking at our region and saying, what's happening? Not just Dearborn, Detroit, and what is our role? What is our role as a regional institution, as an institution on the major arterial cutting through our city itself? And how do we shape that? Mm-hmm. So we're part of a regional discussion. We're part of a discussion here in Dearborn about what does our future look like as a community?
And that brings to mind the other question I had was about your mission when you began versus your mission as it is now and what it's evolving into.
I think the mission is still the same, you know, core mission that we had. It's essentially documenting, celebrating, and preserving the Arab American story from an Arab American perspective, because no one else is doing that. How we do that is obviously evolved over a decade, and it's gotten a little bit bigger because we're a bigger institution over a decade. But that core, who we are and our work, is still there.
Yeah, yeah, great.
We talked about the collection. There's certainly some ongoing exhibits, that is, special displays by certain topics, and I can't remember. I think just three going on currently. You don't have to tell us about all of them. Give one example of one of the current exhibits, in addition to, of course, the main collection.
Well, we have three primary exhibits that are always on display.
Oh, okay.
It's the immigration story, coming to America, living in America, and then making an impact. However, we almost always have at least two temporary exhibits going.
I see.
One of them right now is an exhibition called 10, in honor of our 10th anniversary. It's 10 very, very accomplished Arab American artists exploring identity and what it means to be an Arab American artist. We have a second major exhibition for our anniversary year coming at the end of the year. We're partnering with St. Jude's Children's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, to tell the story of Danny Thomas and the formation of this hospital and its international impact. But what I don't think a lot of people here in Southeast Michigan know is that our exhibits, we have exhibits traveling the nation. So as I mentioned before, our Patriots and Peacemakers exhibit, the one that was on Capitol Hill, it's now heading to the State Department. That's been traveling. It's been the Brown v. Board Education National Historic Site. So that thing's been traveling through 3.5 years nationwide. We have an exhibit that looks at street art coming out of the Arab uprisings in predominantly North Africa and to some extent in Syria, traveling up and down the East Coast. And we have a third exhibit that's been traveling quite extensively called Little Syria, which looks at the first major Arab American community in the lower west side of Manhattan, in an area that was essentially in the shadow of what would become the World Trade Center. So many people don't know. This was the neighborhood of Khalil Gibran, the first Arabic newspapers, the first Arabic churches, the first menis for Arab Americans. So we built this exhibit to better inform people on the rich heritage of Arab Americans. That exhibit, you know, it's got tentatively three or four different venues that's going to be hosting it over the next year and a half. And the final one right now is the Ellis Island Immigration Museum in New York. Again, it's so essential for us not only to document our community's history, but to put that in context with the American story and major institutions where, you know, the greater public will see that and get a deeper understanding of our heritage.
I think the best museums are typically the best storytellers.
Absolutely.
It's not just a matter of having objects that you can see through glass.
Yeah.
Can't touch because they might fall apart. I understand that, but still, it's a matter of telling stories, putting the context together, because it's heritage, but it's also history that we can benefit from in the present.
Absolutely.
If we know the past, that old saw about you don't want to be repeating mistakes or continuing misconceptions and mistaken ideas. And that's going on all the time. So museums are very helpful in that regard. And so on the educational side, those collections, those exhibits that tell such stories are great education. But you also have at your facility a library of print material and other resources that people can do research on.
Absolutely.
Some of these topics.
Yep, we have the archive collection that people can access. We're looking forward to building a major art collection. We do tours for schools and educators and businesses. Almost half of our general attendance visitors are actually school children.
Oh, that's great.
We do cultural competency. A lot of people don't know that about us. We do a whole cultural competency program that educates patrons on who Arab Americans are, and it better informs them so that whatever they're doing, whether they're a teacher in a school district with a lot of Arab Americans or a business that's doing a lot of work with the Arab American community, so they can be empowered to know who they're working with, who they're dealing with, who their constituents are. So that's a program that's been in existence prior to actually the building of the museum, and it's still with us, and it's still a core aspect of our educational outreach.
That's great.
I know in terms of education, there's been Well, at least a half dozen, if not a dozen or more times that I've seen scheduled each year of special discussions and lecture presentations in your auditorium, too, on topics that pertain to Detroit or the nation or, or internationally even. And though I'm not sure if they're regularly scheduled, but they do happen frequently, and I'm always amazed by the people that come in and contribute to those.
Yeah.
And again, all this is open to the public, of course.
Yep.
Sometimes a small admission fee, of course, but
small.
Right. The fun thing that I'd like to jump into in our remaining minutes is the things that WHFR has been involved with the Arab American Museum on too, and that's all the different kinds of cultural events. There's three in particular: Concert of Colors, the Global Music or Global Fridays, it's sometimes referred to as, Yalla Eat.
Yeah.
Okay, we just started talking about Yalla Eat again. This has been so popular. It began last year.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Last year was our pilot year.
As a sort of walking tours among restaurants and food vendors in East Dearborn on Warren Avenue. And you could register for those on the website, and they were sold out pretty quickly.
Yep.
I mean, you can only walk so many people down the street and into these venues. That's come back again. But at this point, primarily, it's down at the around the Eastern Market.
Yes, yes. So we launched two different versions of this, as you mentioned. One is in Warren Avenue in the heart of the Arab American Business District in Dearborn.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks don't realize in the Eastern Market, a lot of the wholesalers are actually Arab Americans, and they've been there for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So we began to, you know, going back to placemaking and this notion of communities and planning, we said to ourselves, you know, it's really great that we're a national museum in East Dearborn, but what is it that is unique about East Dearborn? It's that the community that we represent is right outside our door. I mean, you could come into the museum, you could learn about Arab Americans, but you could leave and actually engage and interact. So how do we take advantage of this? And not only how do we educate our visitors, how do we provide some economic incentive too to the community around us, obviously. So the culinary walking tours is one example of that. It gives visitors a chance to participate in an immersive, participatory, educational experience. It provides our businesses with the opportunity to maybe generate some revenue through new patrons. And it allows us to expand our work in a meaningful way. So we just finished, or we're finishing now, the tours of the Eastern Market, and they're all sold out. They're all to capacity.
I was going to mention, we mentioned it last week.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that because of the mention on the show, that immediately filled up the remaining seats. But I did just check a day or so ago, and it was only like a couple seats left in one, and they're pretty much all sold out.
Absolutely.
So there are, and what do I know? I haven't been in the Eastern Market in a couple decades, and I should be, I mean, going down there. But we got one in Michigan, right here in Dearborn.
Right.
But still, not the same as the big Eastern Market. That area does have Arabic restaurants and food vendors.
Absolutely, there's a variety: importers, butchers, all kinds of stores.
Yep. Well, and the tour in the Warren area is going to come back, I understand, according to the website, maybe in August?
Yes, it'll be happening late summer, early fall. I think we might actually even have some of the dates up, and we're going to open registration for those dates probably in the coming weeks.
Yeah, and that's on, you can see that update on the website, arabamericanmuseum.org, of course. And if people want to do their own tour, it's really great. You now have a printed map,
and
brochure,
of
that tour that people could take for themselves anyway. At least the addresses and locations and the streets are on this little brochure, and that's free for the asking at the Arab American Museum.
Yep, and you could actually download a copy on our website too.
Yes,
as a
you
PDF.
Can. Mine came out like this, upside down and backwards, but it's hard to fold that. But nonetheless, it's all there, and yes, you can download it, and that's a great resource too. So that's Yalla Eat, folks, and the walking tours all sold out down the Eastern Market area now, check back, look ahead for August and September, perhaps, for the Warren Avenue. I'll save Concert of Colors for last. Global Music at your auditorium, which is a wonderful smaller facility, banked floor, comfortable seating in the museum itself, but it only seats about 150. Global Music has now expanded to a new facility that you've acquired and taken over just just east of the museum, just directly next to it, called, and you're calling it the Annex.
The Annex.
So it Global Music Fridays, pretty much once a month, a couple times a month?
Once a month.
The schedule I haven't looked at recently. But
once a month in the spring and the fall. Mm-hmm. We built the Annex, which is a 4,700-square-foot addition. It's separate from the museum, so it allows us a lot of new opportunities. It allows us to essentially shut the museum down and have better community engagement programs throughout the course of the year. So in addition to Global Fridays, we're working on Arabic language lessons, Arabic music lessons. There's going to be a whole host of new innovative programming coming out of that space, and it's going to be done in collaboration with representatives from the Arab American community. So, for example, the music will be taught by the founder and director of the National Arab Orchestra here in Detroit. Our Global Friday series is one of the major programs that we present out of that space, and we'll be releasing the fall schedule very soon. I'm pleased we'll have just a couple of the acts I'll mention now. Black Cube SP, which is a Rob Mazurek project. Rob Mazurek out of Chicago, a key figure in the avant-garde music scene and art scene. We're incredibly excited to be presenting his new ensemble here in Dearborn. We have the Krar Collective from Ethiopia performing as well, which will be great. And the Anna Musri Band, which is an Egyptian-American band based out of Washington, D.C., who'll be performing. And that's just a sampling of what's coming this fall. The really neat thing about the Annex is since we've moved the Global Fridays program over there, we've coupled it with a workshop prior to the performance. So, you know, there's about an hour of opportunity for everything from, you know, in some instances, it's just a presentation on maybe the influence of the musical style that's going to be forthcoming. In other instances, it might be a demonstration or an interactive, you know. In any case, there's always an educational opportunity now, and that's a fun add-on to the actual performance itself, because it gives you an opportunity to actually interact with musicians.
The music and very often the instruments themselves are so unique. And again, we've tried to feature world music on WHFR. It always depends on the amount and quality of our volunteers over the years, because they have to come with that specialized knowledge in order to know what music to acquire. We have a pretty extensive world music library here, but it still takes people that have a special feel and appreciation for it in order to host it. And currently, I'm sorry to say this, as of this week, we don't have a world music show, but it's coming back again with a great host, we think, next week, or at least in 2 weeks.
Oh,
anyway. So we're going to be back in the saddle on that. Moving to Concert Colors, I think the 23rd year coming
23,
up.
23, yep.
And WHFR has been broadcasting as well as participating in Concert Colors since it was down on the riverfront down there on the east side. Maybe that was before your time.
No, I remember the Shane Park days.
Shane Park, yes. And now a lot of it, or at least the part that we participate in, is indoors at the Maxim Fischer Music Center, where, of course, the Symphony Orchestra performs. And that facility, the Orchestra Hall, and their number two stage is inside that facility. And it's just a wonderful, beautiful setting for this wide variety of music. And when can people find out more about Concert Colors happening this year?
Well, we've got the lineup finalized. Our website should be getting updated, most likely, the Concert of Colors website in the next week.
That's concertofcolors.com, folks, by the way.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we should have, you know, flyers, posters, et cetera, out in the community within the next week, 2 weeks. So right around the corner.
I know that at the Maxim Fischer Center that weekend that WHFR is going to participate, and that's always a great free entertainment weekend. There's all kinds of vendors, too, there, both food and information about cultural events, usually inside the building or outside. And usually often, most every year, there's an outdoor stage, too.
Yep.
And weather usually pretty good. I just want to mention the dates. It's July 11th and
12th. 11th and 12th,
yep. Yes, July 11th and 12th is that key weekend. And people just, again, you've got to experience that to see how great it is. In the last couple of years, Concert Colors' roster of artists, it has changed from being exclusively world music artists to more local Detroit artists.
Absolutely.
And that's perhaps because of a funding issue. I mean, as a free concert, you don't have some of the big automotive sponsors that you had, say, 10, 15 years ago.
Sure.
So you could fly people in from Africa, yep. You know. But and I understand that. But Detroit, you know, we're primarily a local music station whenever we can be.
Yeah.
Because we know we got a lot of great musicians here that are just not getting attention that they deserve nationally or sometimes they're getting it internationally, but not nationally, yeah. Interestingly.
So the Don Was Review, which will be back this year, is definitely instrumental in capitalizing. And this year we're actually paying homage to the Electrifying Mojo, so there'll be some really great stuff. But we do have some amazing international music. In addition to this being our 10th year, the Arab American National Museum, mm-hmm. It's the 50th year for the Charles Wright Museum. So we have I think supporters will be happy to see a North African, Arab North African kind of lineup coming with some great stuff. Hassan Hakmoun, I'll let out right now. Maybe King Sunny Ade up there headlining. So some really great performances. I think Metro Detroit's going to be excited.
And we should look for the press release and information coming out on the website, concertofcolors.com, pretty soon, maybe next week sometime. It's getting close, so we're excited about that, and we're excited to be part of that. Let's go over some of the basics of Arab American National Museum. Again, website, arabamericannationalmuseum.org. Location, right across from what used to be the Dearborn City Hall, just the northwest corner of Schaefer Road and Michigan Avenue in what's referred to as East Dearborn. Free parking. Behind the facility. Is entry only from the front?
Technically, you're supposed to, but there is a bell in back, and occasionally our receptionists, if they're not too busy, they'll let you in that way.
I just want to be clear about that, because in the past, I've always come from the parking lot door. But I noticed on the website it says come around to the front off Michigan Avenue.
Absolutely.
Well, that's okay. That's fine. And I think that area, once the art space redevelops the Dearborn City Hall facility, should have a lot of music and artists going on. Should be a really vibrant cultural activity.
Absolutely.
The annex will be extremely popular as a result too, or mm-hmm. continue even mm-hmm. more so than yep. now because of that additional presence there. How expensive is it to get into the museum? Museum is not free.
It's not free, but we're very accessible. It's $8 general admission, seniors, you know, children, educators, it's four. So it's a good price.
I noticed, how did you choose seniors, the ages 59 and up? That's a lot lower than a lot of other places.
We're just...
Boy, all the young
seniors. Generous people at the Arab American National
Museum. That's great.
Museum.
Seniors, 59 and up, folks, you get in for only $4.
Now, it must have been my influence, Jay, because that's the exact...
You're right. Right there, I know. And free admission for children under 6, or if you're a member of the museum, which I noticed, again, for seniors, my category certainly, $35 a year. So
it's very accessible, and I want to mention right now we're in the midst of a major membership campaign. So if you like what we've done over the first decade, please log on right now. Over the next 2 weeks, we're trying to raise a critical mass of memberships. As a community-based museum, membership is it's our lifeline.
And you have so many activities and so many different types of activities that the membership really makes sense, because people, once they understand what's there, they want to come back several times a year. So
several
a membership certainly makes a lot of important choices easy for you in the future. Just go ahead and go because you got the membership. I always recommend, of course, Henry Ford Greenfield Village memberships, because you want to go a lot. They have a lot of things going on. Mm-hmm. But the Arab American Museum, very unique things. Can't find that anywhere else, really, almost in the country.
Yep.
And so, we really want to thank Devin Ackman, who was the director, for coming by today and telling the story. Let's keep that relationship going here with WHFR. We will certainly do our part to get the word out. I know we're on your email and your mailing list, but any way that we can be involved, we certainly want to be in the future, because it's, again, unique cultural undertaking that just people can't become part of this knowledge and this resource any other way except by participating.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and congratulations again, 30 years.
Well, I want to make a quick comment also. Sure. great music and great food. What? How can you beat that with all of our connections that we've had?
Absolutely.
As well as we have our own luncheon buffets happening here at the Henry Ford College for the next 3 weeks.
International food buffets. International food. John's big on food. So.
I think we all are. You and I are both big on food.
All right.
But anyway, I want to invite you to that as well.
So. Thanks so much. Yeah.
And we thank Devin Ackman of the Arab American National Museum for being by today. Here's a couple comments. Jim Hightower, Jack Lessenberry, and a comment about the new state of Michigan budget that was just passed. Did you hear about that one? Okay, we'll talk about that when we get back. The new WHFR Journal continues after these important comments.
If you think that none of today's presidential candidates care about people like you, check out Republican Scott Walker. The Wisconsin governor not only cares, he wants to sit down with you, get your ideas, and stay in close touch. No matter who you are, Scotty wants you to join his team so his presidency can be your presidency. Not a Republican? No problemo, amigo. Walker doesn't check your papers. Well, except for that $1 million check you have to write to his super PAC. That's the ticket price for entering Walker's inner circle, where you can discuss your policy concerns and seek personal favors straight from your lips to the candidate's ear. Even if you're a common working stiff, just give $1 million and you're in. Is this a great country or what? Maybe you're wondering what specifically your money buys. Well, Scott's Super PAC even prints out a handy purchasing slip showing that you'll be, quote, an executive board member of the Walkerites campaign. Thus, you'll have two private dinners with the man, a Walker staffer dedicated to your needs, special briefings and weekly emails, bi-monthly conference calls, biannual retreats, and best of all, quote, an exclusive executive board pin. Golly, I haven't been this excited or felt so included since the 1950s when I became a member of the Mickey Mouse Club and got my own set of mouse ears. This is Jim Hightower saying, when the Supreme Court descended into the Alice in Wonderland fantasy that corporations are people and money is speech, it was inevitable that American politics would devolve to a frivolous game that shuts out the workaday majority and enthrones a Koch brothers plutocracy sustained by secret money super PACs and whorish candidates like Walker. To help end this corrupt mockery of our electoral democracy, go to democracyisforpeople.org.
If you've been following the news for a long time, sometimes the biggest indicator of how things have changed is not stories themselves, but how they're treated. There's a story today buried in the back of the Detroit papers and not even mentioned on most radio news broadcasts, a story that once would have been on the front page of every paper in this state. It said that Ron Bieber, the son of former United Auto Workers President Owen Bieber, had been elected president of the state AFL-CIO. The AFL is still the largest labor federation in the country and, for many years, was both an economic and political powerhouse, both nationally and especially in Michigan. It was once virtually impossible for a Democrat to be nominated for governor or U.S. senator here without strong support from labor. Yet labor's fallen on hard times, and what's happened in Michigan has been perhaps most shocking of all. A decade ago, nobody thought they'd ever live to see this become a right-to-work state, but we have, after a political coup by the legislature in a lame duck session 2.5 years ago. What may have been most surprising is how little backlash there's been since. Nobody has mounted a serious effort to try to repeal right to work. The Democratic candidate for governor last year denounced it, but in fairly muted terms, since he knew that even if he won, he would be powerless to get the legislature to do anything about it. In the end, Democrats lost, and union membership keeps slipping. Last year alone, union membership in Michigan declined from more than 16% of the workforce to barely 14.5%. And that decline is likely to accelerate as contracts negotiated before right to work was passed continue to expire. Right to work means, of course, that workers can no longer be compelled to join or pay dues to a union in any plant or industry. Union membership had already been on the decline for years as companies increasingly outsourced work or preferred to deal with independent contractors, many of whom worked off-site and were extremely hard to organize. I think that the most thoughtful leader of the state AFL in recent years was Mark Gaffney, a member of the Teamsters Union who also had a master's degree in labor relations. But he was ousted 4 years ago after the UAW, the Federation's strongest component, decided it wanted their own Carla Swift instead. Her term, however, was one of virtually unmitigated disaster for Michigan unions. They spent heavily 3 years ago on a referendum to try and get collective bargaining rights enshrined in the state constitution. They lost badly, and lawmakers instantly retaliated with right to work. Now, anti-union forces are making a major effort to end prevailing wage rates on state construction jobs. Ron Bieber, whose father led the state UAW for a dozen years, has his work cut out for him. It's fashionable to beat up on unions these days, but there are still some old-timers who remember what life was like for the average man before they came. You might want to do some research and look into that.
Susan, both Republicans and Democrats were happy about increases in education and early literacy. What kind of investment is the state making in those areas?
We're not seeing huge boosts, but certainly more than we have in recent years. And, you finally saw education budgets pass with bipartisan support, which we really have not seen in the last 4 years.
You know, Kim, this early literacy piece is interesting. We know that in Michigan, 70%, I believe, of fourth grade students don't test at grade level for literacy. So what does this investment in early literacy programs mean?
Well, this third grade reading initiative or early literacy is probably the big new initiative in the budget. And as you pointed out, almost 70% of Michigan fourth graders are not reading at nationally recognized proficiency levels. We're actually 40th among the 50 states, and we're getting worse. So this investment is designed to, in part, train teachers on how to teach reading. It's also to give students in those early grades, kindergarten through third grade, some more time, if you will, in terms of working on this reading issue. It also includes some other things like home visiting programs that maybe will help parents focus on reading with their youngsters. But it is the big new initiative in this budget.
Susan, there is some additional money going towards roads and infrastructure in this budget. But how do the budget numbers measure up against the estimated $2 billion needed for Michigan roads?
Well, what we're seeing is about a $400 million investment, which, obviously is a far cry from $2 billion. And that $2 billion number is an annual cost. So there is an awful lot of one-time money in this budget. So certainly we have not gotten to a comprehensive solution yet.
Ken, anything else stand out in this budget for you?
Well, I think this is a case of an improving economy. It's like a rising tide that lifts all boats, because at the same time they made some increases in education funding, they also found $400 million for roads. But with that being said, given the need for roads, it's still kind of the 900-pound gorilla in the room. And in terms of schools, although there was an increase, not as large as some would have liked.
Susan, now that the budget is out of the way, what do you think is next on the legislative agenda?
Well, as Ken said, roads are still the top issue in the state. And we have indications from both the House and the Senate that they're going to devote a lot of the summer to trying to identify a comprehensive solution.
And Ken, seeing how that has panned out so far, what do you think the chances are of them actually finding something that works?
Well, they have to find something that works. This legislature will, it's a defining issue for them to solve this road problem. And even House Republicans that are trying to advance a bill or legislation that doesn't include new revenue, even most of them are recognizing that some new revenue has got to come into roads.
Ken Sikkema is Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants, and Susan Demas is publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. Ken, Susan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're back with the new WHFR Journal for Friday, June the 5th, 2015. Jay Koronick and John Conroy with you here. What we just heard, in addition to, of course, the commentaries from Jim Hightower and also Jack Lessenberry, locally Jack Lessenberry, was this report from Michigan Radio that is the really statewide network of public radio stations that there is some relationship to WDET, but they don't play the stories of the other Michigan radio affiliates in completely. So I do highly recommend you go to their website, not just to listen to these little podcast sound bites, but also to see the stories. They actually write up stories too and put them on their website, michiganradio.org. It's a great source for local and state news in Michigan, very objective source. And we were listening to Michigan Radio's Jennifer White, who was interviewing Susan DeMoss, who's the involved with, she's a publisher, actually, of Inside Michigan Politics, which is a very expensive newsletter that comes out, I think it's monthly, maybe weekly, about what's happening in Lansing. And that's because almost nobody knows except a few insiders. And because there isn't a continuing presence of reporters in Lansing. No, there isn't. They don't live there anymore. Seriously, if they're reporting to the News of the Free Press, they just sort of visit every now and then, make some phone calls. And you can't really know what's going on unless you're sort of like in the halls, in the hallowed halls yourself, and behind the scenes a little more. So they also brought in for that report about the Michigan budget, Ken Sikkema. His name might be familiar with him. He was the former Senate Majority Leader, Republican, and now he's a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants, which is a fancy name for Republican lobbyist. Okay, for Republican causes. Sorry to mention that, but let's see. John, you're on mic two now. Okay.
I'm on the same.
Yeah.
I'm still on the same mic.
The same one you were, right. Yep. But
I just moved.
Changed seats. Yeah, it's very sneaky. all right. And their point was is that no new money for roads.
Hmm.
That's nothing in the budget. Well, $400 million, but they always put some money out for roads anyway. And we really need, as experts are saying now, close to $1.8 or more billion dollars a year for 10 years just to catch up from the terrible situation that the state is in right now in all of our roads, in all of our communities and statewide roads too. So that's still an issue that has to be solved somehow. Nothing in the budget that was just approved about that. A slight increase in money for education, not as much as people in education wanted, of course. But I say, of course, is because Michigan has underfunded education compared to other states, especially higher education, for decades, okay, which is one reason why our tuition to certainly the four-year schools is so high. It's because nobody else is helping them out. And of course, that's becoming almost impossible for people to ever pay back. I mean, they can't pay for it up front unless they're super rich. They can't pay for that tuition up front anymore. They have to pay for it after they take out loans. And I noticed that there's a bill in Congress that would keep the loans from being any more than 8.25%. And I'm thinking, where does that come from? You can get a house mortgage now for 3 or 4%. What's better in the long run, a house or a college education? I mean, for the sake of the country. I mean, 8.25, that's still a terrible deal.
Yeah.
And we have a college student in the studio now who's shaking her head yes in agreement. So almost every college student is taking the hit on this, including our operations manager, Laura, who just got her doctorate from Wayne State University.
Mm.
And she may be living with that loan for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
No, seriously. It's and she's refinanced down, and it's not much down below 8 or 6. I mean, that's the radical bill for reducing debt that Bernie Sanders, who's also running for the Democratic presidential nomination, and he's thought to be, radical socialist, whatever. Well, that's his bill, to reduce it to no more than 8.5. That's just sure, he wants to have free college tuition somehow for four-year schools and two-year public schools. So that's what he wants. But this bill that he's endorsed is just something that might be possible, but there's no support at all. And this is a crime against the next generation, the current generation, because they're still paying off debts from college years ago. Mm-hmm. So we've got to do something there. Well, just wanted to mention that. Getting to local stories, because that's what WHFR Journal is supposedly all about. But some of these things affect all of us.
Oh, they affect.
So, like, the college student in our studios right now. It affects all of us here.
And of course, my own son is paying back student loans for law school. You know, it's going to take him. He thinks it's going to take him till age 55 to pay those back.
Huh? You know, well, good luck.
20 something years.
Yeah, and well, they don't pay lawyers like they used to either.
No.
Anyway, here's something happening at Henry Ford College. It's our special MTech Center, which is known for advanced technology and retraining for workers in the Detroit area. But they have, oh boy, they got a lot of computers, they got a lot of math. They have a new facility in the old area of the old Ford Rotunda Center, which burned down in the 50s, I think. But anyway, in that part of East Dearborn is where our MTech building is. And they have a special new program starting up in just a week or so. It's called the Camp Henry Program. Let me explain. It runs just for 1 week from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m., Monday, June 15th to Friday, June 19th. Okay, it's for teenagers. Okay. The opportunity incorporates authentic project and inquiry-based challenges to stimulate necessary 21st century skills. That seems like a lot of gobbledygook. But this is individual and team activities allowing students to learn science, technology, engineering, and math, also known as the education trade as the STEM program, science, technology, education, and math. And you can learn that content through application, critical thinking, and problem solving. So this is very real-world experiences for students. And they indicate teenagers. I'm not sure exactly what age. I guess it starts at 13, right?
13.
Last time I checked.
Yeah.
Could go through 19, which means you might already be out of high school. But anyway, this seems like a great experience. And maybe the Dearborn schools are even out of session at that point. That could be the week that they're first off. And so this would be a great opportunity. I know nothing about the details, except you have to go to the Henry Ford College website. It says seats are going fast for this experience for teenagers, Monday, June 15th through Friday, June 19th, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m., learning science, technology, engineering, and math in real-world projects and activities. And they've got the equipment and facilities for it at MTech. So I could give you the whole website address, but maybe you'll have to call somebody at the college at one of the main numbers here, because you probably can't write this down and remember it. hfcc.edu is still our website address, /news/items. And then there's, oh my gosh, 13 numbers. But that's where you can sign up. But I'm not going to give the number. Okay, the numbers, if you're listening to the podcast, you can rewind this. 1-431-964-637. 1-431-964-637. That's the project Lead the Way through MTech's Division's Camp Henry program. A lot of big words there. What's happening in Dearborn, John? What else do you want to talk about?
Well, I just wanted to add up on that. That's directly after school gets out, so their minds should still be somewhat connected to the school world at that point.
And I also believe that parochial schools in the area are out much earlier. In fact, some are out already.
Already, yes.
Yeah. Yep. So I know my daughter is in a parochial school in Allen Park, and this is the last week. So, in fact, I think they're out today, totally. Okay. Well, the community here in Dearborn, we said goodbye to Brian Whiston, and he is, of course, moving to his new superintendent position as state superintendent of Michigan. There was a gathering for him last week. About 250 people attended. They actually brought somebody down from the state to give him the oath of new office. That made it special. And he has a statement that will appear in next week's papers. He says, this is the point. Of course, he thanked everyone in the district for the years of working together and so on. But you don't often hear an education leader having this point of view, too. He says, it's important to recognize the strong union leadership we are very fortunate to have here in Dearborn. In other cities and states, unions have taken a bit of a beating. I'm very proud of the work our unions, he's talking about the teacher unions, and the unions that represent administrators and also the support staff, too. He says, I'm very proud of the work they've done in Dearborn, honored to call them a partner in education. Our union leadership has worked with the district to save money, maintain jobs, and provide the very best education to the students in our schools. I applaud their efforts and hope other organizations can learn from the partnership we have formed with our unions here in Dearborn. just don't hear that too much from a lot of people in business and elsewhere or on Fox News. And it's certainly true here in Dearborn. We know how to work together, and unions are good things in the educational endeavor. He even quoted Superintendent Whiston in his last statement here. He even quoted Ernest Hemingway. Hemingway once said, "It's good to have an end to a journey toward, but it is the journey that matters in the end." What is that? Whatever that means. Okay. In other words, he's ending one journey and he's beginning
another journey.
Got to keep doing stuff that matters. That's very important. So let's keep talking about other stories here. We only have 7 minutes left to the hour, John. So you want to hit a topic?
Well, I'll hit a couple events that are happening this weekend. Local downriver, actually, events. We have a Trenton Village Theater tomorrow night, Saturday night, 7 p.m. Bill Bynum and his group are performing their last performance with their violinist, Mary. At 7 o'clock, $10 for adults, $5 for seniors and kids. Sunday the 7th will be a presentation of S.F. Lewis, or C.S. Lewis, and his teachings from a gentleman named Mark McPherson. I know you know him, Jay.
Yes, he's a great presenter of many different kinds of topics. For a while, he was even doing some ghost busting years ago, and he's done lectures on other historical figures too. He's a great researcher, great performer, so that should be great. Some of the writings of C.S. Lewis.
And he'll be doing this at 3 o'clock at Sacred Heart Church to benefit their building fund.
Right, C.S. Lewis was a Christian. He had his own version of Christianity, which I won't go into right now, but certainly. People who are Christians might want to read C.S. Lewis and see. He wrote fiction as well as, of course, many essays. So I'm sure Mark Ferson will do a great job of presenting that. Shifting back to next week, Wednesday, Dearborn Heights Spirit Fest, which is pretty big in this area and is one of the first city spirit festivals of that sort, or city carnival-type festivals that will be getting started. So next Wednesday, June 10th, and it'll be running through next Sunday, June 14th, at the Canfield Community Center grounds on Beach Daily, one block south of Ford Road. 5-day event sponsored by Antonio's Cucina Italiana features the city's largest amusement ride midway, a variety of ethnic food, live entertainment, and many special events. Of course, on Wednesday and Thursday and Friday, it's limited to afternoons, evenings, but noon to 11 p.m. next Saturday and Sunday, that's the Dearborn Heights Spirit Fest.
You wanted to mention the memorial service this Sunday.
Yes, on Sunday, June 7th, I mentioned this last week, but it is coming up. Those that wanted to share memories with others about the great career and life of Dale Van Dorp, who was a member of the Henry Ford College faculty, but also a great theater person, actor, director for decades here in Dearborn, and also known to the Dearborn Parks and Recreations Department and everyone else at major events like Homecoming, the voice of Dearborn. Mm-hmm. That was Dale Van Dorp, and he passed away on May 10th, and the memorial service will be this coming Sunday, this coming Sunday, 2 days. Yes, 2 days from now, the 7th at 1 p.m. at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center.
I just want to mention again, we have our continuing buffet going on with the Henry Ford 5101 restaurant from the next three Thursdays, 11 to 1 for $14. Come and have a great time, great meal, and great drink as well.
June 11th is Spanish New World. So next week's, it's the Spanish New World. Is that Mexican?
Spanish.
I'm not sure, but, you know, New World is us, this side of the planet, right?
And
Spanish influences are certainly, we'll find out. We'll find out when we get there.
Oh, yeah.
That's always great. So that's at the 5101 restaurant. The international buffets continue for only another 3 weeks. And as John said, it's Thursdays. From 11 to 1. If you want reservations, that's fine. 313-206-5101. 313-206-5101. I think it's $14 a person, yes, if you're interested. Okay.
Friday, June 12th, there's a patriotic concert going to be held again. This has been happening, for at least 8 years now, with out of Brownstown Township, 7 p.m., all patriotic music for about an hour and a half of great sounds, only $8 per person.
Wow. Well, we're jumping around a little bit. I just found this. I should have followed the superintendent's, Wiston's comments, but the school board in Dearborn is now down to four candidates to replace him. And I'll just briefly mention, two are from the Dearborn Public Schools, currently on the staff of the Dearborn Public Schools, a Dr. Glenn Maleko, who is currently executive director of human resources, a Dr. Gail Schenkman, associate superintendent, Dearborn Public Schools. Dr. John Van Wagener is from Shiawassee. Okay, he's associate superintendent of general ed in Shiawassee. And Dr. Ron Wilson is former superintendent in Cass City and also Howell Public Schools. So those are the four final candidates. Public interviews will be held on June 9th. Okay, next week, and they start at 5:30 p.m., and June 11th, starting at 6, interviews will be held in the boardroom in the administration building. That's on Audette in Dearborn. So all four candidates will be contacted and scheduled for one of two interviews to be held each night. So that is coming up. City of Dearborn also, you know, they've now had their last budget meeting, and final approval will be on June 11th. That'll be next Thursday. According to my calendar, that's not a typical day for the City Council of Dearborn to meet, but by golly, that's when they're going to approve the budget for next year, and who knows what is in that. Maybe on the website, cityofdearborn.org, they'll still maybe take a few comments, although it's pretty much a done deal what's going to be voted on, I bet. Let's see, a couple of other issues. It is 2 o'clock. It's time for Highway 61 to get started, and Joanne Korchinska is on her way into the station, and my colleague John has gone out to meet her and to get her in here in just another couple minutes. So let me do a little bit more stories here to finish up. The Lansing story, the budget. Here's a little supplement that was posted on somebody's blog. I don't know where this was. It might, I'm not sure where, but here's the story from a Michael Jackman that was posted yesterday. Sweet, sweet harmony in Lansing. It says, our readers may notice that we often make a bit of fun when it comes to our Lansing legislators. Their ongoing inability to come up with a comprehensive plan to fix the state's degrading roads puts us in the mind of an old joke. Why don't Lansing's lawmakers look out the window in the morning? Because then they'd have nothing to do all afternoon. Okay. Then he goes on to say, yeah, we're still sore about that referendum they hastily cooked up and kicked to the public, and which the public rightly deep-sixed. Roads are the economic lifeblood of the state. What on earth are they doing if not focusing like a laser beam on fixing them? Clearly, state legislators' roads just aren't a big deal. What, we need all sorts of money to overhaul the roads? They find it hard to believe. Certainly State Senator Dave Hildebrand, Republican, has scoffed at the price tag. Almost 2 years ago, he said, there are some roads that need work, but I have been able to swallow this need for $1.2 billion per year more when we're already spending $3 billion a year. I have been able to grasp that. Unquote. And the writer here says, what can Senator Hildebrand understand then? How about the sweet, sweet harmonizing of barbershop quartets? That topic caused the normally doubtful salon to speedily introduce a resolution declaring a barbershop harmony day. Clearly, some things don't matter much, like all this money that's supposed to be raised for the state infrastructure, but other things, like music with consonant four-part chords for every melody note, demand quick and decisive action. Aren't we fortunate to